In continuing in looking at the four Gospels and New Testament times, especially the times during the life of Jesus, we need to look now at political factors. And so in the back of your Bibles or in a Bible atlas, if you can turn to a map of the Roman Empire, it might help you. And I'm just going to give you some basic fill-in information here about Rome. It's not a great big history of Rome, it's just some pertinent information. Rome started to come to international prominence in the middle of the 2nd century BC. In that era, they had defeated Carthage, in modern-day Tunisia, Syria, and Macedonia, in modern-day Greece, in battle. Augustus, who was emperor from 27 BC to 14 AD, established and maintained peace in the empire after the power struggles between three persons in the generation before him. The three persons were the general Pompey, P-O-M-P-E-Y. He's the man who brought Roman rule to the Middle East in the 60s BC. Crassus, who was the head of the Senate in Rome, and Julius Caesar. Now, after Julius Caesar was assassinated in 44 BC, there was a power struggle between Mark Antony and Octavian. Octavian was to become Augustus. Octavian won out over Mark Antony and was known as emperor, took the name Augustus, and he was the one who, through his skillful rule and through his fairly modest lifestyle, he was not a person who was concerned to live above everybody else in the empire. He was a very modest individual and wanted to be known more as a man of the people than known as emperor. But through Augustus's wise administration, this is when we got the Pax Romana, the peace throughout the Roman Empire. He was concerned to promote stability through the extension of Roman law and Greco-Roman culture. Well, we say Greco-Roman because the Romans very much relied on the Greek Empire before them for a lot of their structures and a lot of their art and a lot of their literature and a lot of their ways of doing things, even planning cities. And so even though the Greek Empire was ended, there is such a thing in the ancient world as Hellenism, Greekism, if you like, the influence of Greek thought, Greek culture, Greek philosophy, and so on. And this pervaded Roman society. And so they brought this Hellenistic view, as well as with Roman law and some Roman culture and so on, while respecting as much as possible the cultures of those in the empire. Now, Augustus's stepson was Tiberius, who reigned from AD 14 to AD 37. And so, of course, he's the one who is the emperor during the ministry of Jesus Christ. Tiberius was more tyrannical, more suspecting, and his traits were exacerbated with his successors into the apostolic era, all the way up to Nero, of course, set Rome on fire. Roman rule was often supervisory, with much of the day-to-day running being placed in the hands of trusted nationals, as much as possible. Herod the Great, who reigned as king, he actually got the title of king from Augustus, reigned from 37 BC to 4 BC. He had both Idumean and Jewish ancestry. Idumea was a territory to the south of Israel, southeast. And he was a very capable and ambitious ruler and an admirer of Roman culture and tried to bring these things into Judea while respecting to a certain amount the religion of the Jews. He himself thought of himself as a Jew. The Jews didn't think of him that way, though. He was one of the great builders of the ancient world, constructing many theatres, amphitheatres, aqueducts, fortresses, and of course the temple under his long reign. The temple was basically a rebuilding of the temple of Ezra and Nehemiah, and under his great building project it became the most spectacular structure probably in the ancient world, especially religious structure. There is nothing else like it in the ancient world as far as a temple that's dedicated to a god. You think about the temple at Ephesus, of course, one of the seven wonders of the world, which existed at this time, but even that was not really to compare to the Jerusalem temple. Under his reign, Judea became quite prosperous, even though he was quite a tyrant and could be a very suspicious and very cruel leader. And of course, we read about the so-called massacre of the innocents at the time of Jesus, when after the wise men had departed another way, after worshipping the Christ child, he, knowing that the Christ was born in Bethlehem, he sent his soldiers into Bethlehem to kill every child under, boy child under 2 years of age. And he did that to make sure that Jesus would not be a rival king to him and his dynasty. Now, some people have said, well, there is no other attestation of that in the ancient world. Well, we don't need an attestation outside of the scriptures. The scriptures are an inspired word of God, and they tell us true history. But even if we don't have that attestation, this fits with the kind of person that Herod was. We know that he had two of his wives killed. He had his son Antipater killed just before his own death. In fact, he was such a awful individual that he arranged for the Roman soldiers to kill thousands of Jewish leaders on the day of his death, so that there would be great mourning in Israel. Now, by the way, the Roman soldiers didn't do that. Once they heard that Herod was dead, they feared the political and religious consequences of doing that, and so they didn't carry out Herod's order. But he wanted there to be a great mourning in Israel on the day of his death, and so he ordered that thousands of Jewish leaders be put to death on the day he died. What a person. What an individual. Now, after Herod's death, his kingdom was split between Herod Antipas, who got Galilee and Perea, Philip, who got Trachonitis and Iturea in the northeast, across from the Jordan, and Archelaus, who was given Judea, Samaria, and Idumea to the south. So Archelaus was given kind of the prize territories. Now we read, of course, of the fact that when Joseph, coming back from Egypt with the young Christ, found out that Archelaus was the ruler in Judea in the place of Herod, that he decided was not a good decision to return to Bethlehem. And, of course, being warned by an angel, he went north to Nazareth. Archelaus was a very wicked individual, and he was a very inept ruler as well. We know from history that he instituted a number of ventures against the people to put down the people, the Jews, that incited them so much that they actually banded together with the Samaritans, would you believe, to send a delegation to Rome to speak to Augustus to do something about this individual. And so Augustus, in AD 6, banished Archelaus to Vienne in Gaul, modern-day France. And that's where he spent the rest of his life. His territories were not divided between Herod Antipas and Philip, his brothers, but were instead placed under the rule of a Roman governor. And so this is how the Roman governor would be in charge of Judea at the time of Christ's trial. Now, of course, Pontius Pilate is known to have been governor at the time of Christ's ministry, and he was governor or prefect, to give it its technical name, over Judea from AD 26 to AD 36. Pilate is known from an inscription that was found at Caesarea Maritima in the northwest on the coast there, which was a city built by Herod, which gives him his designated name of prefect over Judea. And he's characterized not only by the Gospels as being cruel and unscrupulous, but also by Josephus, the famous Jewish historian who wrote between about AD 70 and AD 100. Philo, the famous Jewish scholar who died in AD 50, wrote from Alexandria, and other sources. They say that he's cruel, he was greedy, and that he would do anything to secure his power base. He was also anti-Semitic. He obtained his position through the influence of his friend Sejanus, S-E-J-A-N-U-S, who was captain over the Roman Praetorian Guard until his execution by Tiberius in AD 31. Note that date, AD 31. Now, Sejanus was the main supporter of Pontius Pilate, which meant that as a friend of Sejanus, Pontius Pilate would have been in a pretty precarious position with the emperor at about the time, and during the time of Christ's trial. You see that. So this may be some of the reason why Pilate appears as vacillating and as kind of in two minds about what to do with Jesus, because his power base had been eroded, and so he was insecure, and he didn't have the kind of assurance and confidence that he'd had earlier. Jesus himself speaks in Luke chapter 13, I believe, of Pilate mixing the blood of some Galileans with their sacrifices. Gives you an impression of the kind of cruel individual that he was. He was known for setting up Roman standards in and around Jerusalem, which needlessly excited the Jews. After Sejanus' death, he tried to ingratiate himself with Tiberius by bringing in standards, again, into Jerusalem with Tiberius' name on them. Tiberius found out about this. He was not happy at all with Pilate. Finally, he was deposed in AD 36, and we don't know what happened to him after that time. The rumor was that he committed suicide, but there's no evidence to support that claim. So, after Sejanus' downfall, then, in AD 31, Pilate's position with Rome was certainly tenuous. Again, this explains, I think, his issues when the Jews asserted in John 19:12 that if he let Jesus go, he was no friend of Caesar's. You know, that was a very pointed accusation at that time. And so the Romans, they had a garrison at Jerusalem, and they certainly had a strong presence there, but they tried to be hands-off as much as they could be, because the Jews were well known for being difficult, and so Rome didn't want any trouble. If they could have these people live under their rule and just carry on with their religion, then they were happy to do that. And every so often there were sort of outbreaks, and again in AD 6 there was an individual called Judas who started up a movement of rebellion against Rome. And then later on, of course, there was rebellion, AD 66 to AD 70. And then in the next century, the Bar Kokhba rebellion as well in the 130s AD. That was the thing that really broke the camel's back, and the Emperor Hadrian got rid of all of the, or nearly all of the Jews from Israel, and renamed it Palestine in the wake of that rebellion there. So Tiberius didn't want any trouble, and he didn't want Pontius Pilate making trouble. Because Sejanus wasn't replaced until AD 31, those that place the trial and death of Christ at AD 30, I think, have some problems, because it becomes more difficult to explain Pilate's vacillation if he still had a strong power base and strong assurance at that time, you see. So I think those that give a traditional date of AD 32 or AD 33 for the death of Christ are in a stronger position. Moving on, just to say a few things about the diaspora, the spread of the Jews. This happened, of course, after the 586 BC deportation of the Jews under the Babylonians. And there was a large Jewish enclave in Babylon at this time. Certainly a large Jewish population there. There was a very large Jewish population in Alexandria at that time. In fact, the largest concentration of Jews anywhere was probably at Alexandria, at least outside of the land of Israel. Probably 300,000 or 400,000 people in Alexandria at that time were Jews. In Asia Minor, many Jews could be found in and around the cities. They often congregated in the cities. In Rome, there was a Jewish population. They were expelled in the 40s by Claudius, but there was a large Jewish population there. In Ephesus, there was certainly a large Jewish population, and many of the other cities had concentrations of Jews. And even in the Decapolis, across the Jordan from the mainland of Israel, in those cities, those 10 cities, we know that there was a large Jewish population that existed at that particular time. Now, we have said that the Jews did have a strong sense of identity, particularly those that had stayed in the land. Nevertheless, even those that had kind of merged with the Hellenistic culture and kind of been influenced strongly by Hellenism, being outside of Israel, they still saw themselves as Jews, and they still came to the temple in droves every year to worship at the temple, and particularly at Passover. And that explains, of course, why there were so many people in Israel at the time of Jesus' trial and execution, and also at Pentecost a little bit later. Now, the Jews had certain things that kept this identity together, even outside of the land. The major thing was probably the Septuagint, or the LXX, Roman for the number 70. Now, the Septuagint, we'll say something about that when we deal with the canon of Scripture, but the Septuagint was a Greek translation of the Hebrew Torah that was begun in the middle of the 3rd century BC under the reign of Ptolemy Philadelphus in Alexandria. Some Jews, as the legend goes, and I believe it is a legend, came from Jerusalem, from each tribe. Scholars came to Alexandria to translate the Torah, not the whole of the Old Testament, just the Torah, into Greek. And I think that certainly happened, and most scholars believe that that happened, but just not the way that it's usually been passed down in, like, the letter to Aristeas and other sources. But certainly, the Jews of Alexandria and other Greek-speaking cities had the Torah in their native language, in the Greek language, by the 2nd century BC. And we know that there were translations done at different parts of the empire in those centuries before the time of Christ, which filled out the prophets and the history books and the Psalms and so on. So certainly there was an old Greek Old Testament translation that was available to many Jews outside the empire. Now remember that these Jews would not be Aramaic speaking Jews because they'd grown up outside of an Aramaic culture. They were Greek speaking. In fact, very often, we know this from looking at artifacts from Ephesus and other places, they were so Hellenized that they would actually merge some of their Jewish religion with some of the Hellenistic religions as well. And this was the beginning of the mystical side of the Jewish religion, which came out a little bit later in the Kabbalah and so on. We do know, therefore, that the LXX had this large following. And this is why Paul can write to Timothy, who is an Hellenized Jew, and says that you have known the Holy Scriptures from a child in 2 Timothy chapter 3, verses 14 and 15, 16, that he was reared on them, you see. Well, how on earth could he be reared on Hebrew Scriptures? He couldn't read Hebrew. Well, he wasn't reared on Hebrew Scriptures. He was reared on Greek Scriptures, Greek translation of the Scriptures. And studies have been made, for example, by Timothy McClay and other people, which have shown this close association between the writings of Paul and the writings of the gospel authors and the translation, the LXX. And so we know it was very influential at that time. In fact, even in Jerusalem, Zahn tells us in his introduction to the New Testament that there was a large Greek-speaking synagogue in Jerusalem at this time, the time of Christ. Many people who had come from the diaspora to live at Jerusalem couldn't speak Aramaic, but they could still worship, you see, using the Septuagint. Now, of course, in Israel generally, it was the Hebrew that was used, but the Hebrew was used by the scribes and so on. Most people didn't speak Hebrew. Most people spoke Aramaic, which is a form or a cognate to the Hebrew language, but with some differences. Now, the teaching was often done through the traditions of the elders. And these traditions of the elders, the scribes and so on, were handed down, and they were kind of the interpretations of how do we apply, particularly the Torah, to day-to-day circumstances? And these interpretations would eventually form what is known as the Mishnah, the oral traditions of the elders. Now, the Mishnah was not formed until about the second century outside the apostolic era, but it had its beginnings certainly before the time of Christ. Now, also, because the Hebrew text, of course, was read in the synagogue and read in the temple and read in the religious meetings, it had to be, in a sense, translated or paraphrased into the Aramaic with some embellishment. And these embellishments and translations into Aramaic were known as the Targums. And very often what would happen, and you see this in Luke chapter 4, there's Jesus, he's handed the scroll of one of the prophets, and he reads it, and then he sits down, and then everybody's expecting him to teach, you see. You would teach in a seated position. And, of course, he said, well, this day, this prophecy has been fulfilled in your hearing, you know, citing Isaiah 61. And, you know, that provoked a bit of a reaction, didn't it? But usually there would be a teacher there, someone known as a rabbi, as a scholar, who would read the Hebrew text and then would targum it. In other words, he would translate it and then he would speak about it. Very often these embellishments would be quotations from the elders and then, you know, sometimes stories, sometimes humorous stories. This modern plague of anecdotes and stories that we have in the pulpit nowadays, nothing new about that. It used to happen back then. But Christ taught as a true teacher of the law. And so you had these, and these helped to preserve the Jewish identity as well as what we've said about Judaism and its history previously. We've talked about the Greek culture in art and in philosophy, and these, of course, did have an impact on all the peoples. You couldn't escape it. And this is why, as we will see, there are traces of that culture even in the religious centers of Israel at this time. Going on to the religious factors then, the temple was famous throughout the empire, as we have already said. Well, let's say a few things, therefore, about the temple. The temple was famous throughout the whole Roman Empire and may have been the largest religious structure in the Roman world. Herod began rebuilding the temple in around 20 or 19 BC. And it was completed within 10 years, all apart from its adornments, which were not finalized until about 64 AD. The Jewish temple was under Jewish control, and therefore, I hope that you can see that it gained fresh symbolic status for many of the Jews. It really was the thing that made them Jews in their minds. Now, certain apocalyptic groups, like the Essenes, who we'll look at in a few minutes' time, disregarded the temple, seeing themselves as the true priesthood who would one day erect Ezekiel's new temple. But when I say they disregarded the temple, I'm not saying that the temple itself was unimportant to these groups, just that the people that ran it and the things that went on in the temple were disregarded, and therefore they didn't worship at the temple. They believed it was polluted for that reason. Let's look at some of these different groups that made up Judaism at the time of Christ. And I suppose the first group would be the Pharisees. The Pharisees were a very significant group within Jewish life. These men were formed sometime in the 2nd century BC and saw themselves as watchmen over the law and the traditions of the rabbis. And let me give you two references here that might help, Matthew 23:2 and Matthew 15:1 and following. Look up those references and you'll see how they saw that they were in the place, speaking in a sense on behalf of Moses and the tradition. The name Pharisee means separated one. They were particularly scrupulous about Sabbath observance, ritual purity, and tithing, and the teaching of the Torah. They would not share a meal with anyone who was not careful to observe these duties. And so look at John 9 and Luke 18 in that respect. They were drawn from all parts of Jewish society, although they were most influential within the common sectors, the lower strata of the Judean society. They were rather disdainful of Galileans, and I suppose were more respected than liked. They were most influential around the synagogues in Judea, where they would teach the people the meaning of the law and how to observe it in everyday life, the teaching that would come down to be known as Midrash. They used a form of interpretation called Pesher, P-E-S-H-E-R, that tried to bring in this kind of application to the interpretation of the Torah. And some New Testament scholars have tried to say that that is how the Gospel writers were using their interpretation, Pesher interpretation. I don't agree with that. Not every New Testament scholar agrees with that, but you do need to know that some people mention it in their commentaries. There is no evidence that they actually organized synagogues or that they were employed by synagogues as rulers over them, but they came in, as it were, as authorities in the synagogues and taught. They believed in the immortality of the soul, the future resurrection. They believed in angels and demons, and in a strange combination of predestination and free will. And you'll see that in Blomberg. They actually believed also in fate, but not that everything was up to fate. This is how the Romans viewed things. Just in the influence of fate in a lot of life, but also in God's sovereignty in life. It's a kind of a strange mix. The group itself does not appear after the destruction of the temple in 70 AD. But the rabbis who arose a generation or more later were strongly influenced by the teaching of the Pharisees. That is important to note. They were craftsmen and artisans. They weren't full-time Pharisees, as it were. They also had trades. And they were not one homogeneous group. They had differences between them. As we know, for example, between the followers of the famous Rabbi Hillel, H-I-L-L-E-L, who died in the first century A.D., who was kind of, I suppose, fairly lax in his views of things like divorce and so on. He believed that a Jew could divorce for any reason. And the followers of Shammai, S-H-A-M-M-A-I, who was more strict, more conservative. It appears, interestingly, that they only went up to Galilee out of a sense of religious duty, or to check out some new teacher. And you might look at Mark 7:1 in that regard, where it says that the Pharisees came down from Judea to see what Jesus was teaching, what he was doing. In J.D.G. Dunn's book, Jesus Remembered, page 307, we read this about them. He says that the dispute on whether Pharisees were resident or active in Galilee during this period also bears on this subject. It is true that the record of great Torah scholars in Galilee is minimal. And he quotes here from Richard Horsley, who observes that a much fuller role attributed to the Pharisees in the Gospels would have no credibility unless they did historically, on occasion at least, appear outside of their focus of operations in Jerusalem. And he refers particularly to the tradition of Luke 11:43 and Mark 12:38-39 to talk about their presence in Galilee. So he says, Dunn on page 307, that in all likelihood they were located in Judea, the Pharisees, and would only come out of Jerusalem or Judea to Galilee when they felt that they needed to. It does fit when the Gospels say that they loved the places of honor, the best seats in the synagogue in Mark 12 and Luke 20:46, Matthew 23:6. It does kind of fit in with what we know about them. They believed that they had a kind of honor and a respect that was due to them because of their position. And of course, Jesus remonstrated against them because of that. They were quite scrupulous about their views and about the keeping of the law. And of course, Jesus himself inveighed against this in Matthew 23 particularly. They understood the grace of God in one sense. They were not complete legalists. They understood the grace of God in condescending to choose Israel. The problem is they misapplied the grace of God and didn't see that they were in need of it. Look at John chapter 9, where they said to the man born blind, you know, you were born a sinner, and therefore you can't instruct us. When they were calling him a sinner, that was certainly a pejorative term to somebody who was not an observer of the whole law in the way that the Pharisees interpreted it. That's what a sinner was in their view. So there's the Pharisees. We can say that they were popular. They weren't always followed, but they had the respect of the common people. And I think that is important. They were very often drawn from the common people. Then you had the Sadducees. The Sadducees were certainly not as popular as the Pharisees were, and very little is known about them. Their name seems to be derived from Zadok and his priesthood. Look at 2 Samuel 8:17. And they claim to be named from the Zadokites. It appears they were drawn almost entirely from the upper and upper middle classes. Thus, they were unpopular with the masses, but held all of the important positions. The Romans chose the high priest, for example, and the high priests were generally chosen from Sadducean families. Very often they were corrupt, by the way, and the house of Annas is well known as being a corrupt house. For example, there was certainly an inherent nepotism within the house of Annas that even was passed down into writings. Well, here's the lament of Abba Saul, a contemporary of Annas's dynasty, who wrote, "Woe is me for the house of Hanim," that is Annas, "woe is me for their whisperings, for they are the high priests, their sons are the treasurers, their sons-in-law are temple officers, and their servants beat the people with cudgels." That shows that the Sadducees certainly were not beyond being corrupted by Roman influence and, of course, the influence of the upper classes. In fact, there was considerable overlap between the Sadducees and the aristocratic families of the high priests, and Dunn tells us that in his book. And Dunn thinks that this is crucial when one is identifying the Jews, quote-unquote, responsible for the death of Jesus, because certainly the Sadducees, not just the Pharisees, but the Sadducees would have been baying for his blood because, of course, Annas, Caiaphas, and so on were from the Sadducean party, not the Pharisean party. They seem to have become very corrupt during Jesus' lifetime and were probably partly responsible for bringing the money changers into the temple area instead of keeping them outside of its environs. Look at Mark 11, 15 through 11. And I think that fits in with what I've just read there from Abba Saul and the nepotism that was involved. They generally supported the status quo, as is often the case with the upper classes. In England, for example, the upper classes during the early years of Hitler were actually supporters of Hitler. And they did that because they believed it was the best way to preserve the status quo. What the status quo being, their positions. There's nothing new about that. Generally, the upper classes have done that to keep their positions. There is no Jewish movement called the Sadducees after AD 70. And in fact, no Jewish movement even claimed to have a descendant from the Sadducees after AD 70. So you can see what the scorn that they were held in by most people. They denied the resurrection. Look at Mark 12, 18 through 27. They denied and repudiated the oral traditions of the Pharisees. They denied the immortality of the soul. They denied angels and demons, so they were kind of liberal in a lot of their theology. And they were quite deistic in their view of God's involvement in human affairs, according to Graham Stanton. That is, they believe that God kind of set things off and kind of then sat back in the universe and let things tick the way that he had set them up to go. Josephus, who was a Pharisee, wrote in his Antiquities, quote, "They win over the wealthy. They do not have the people on their side." But they were an influential group. Some other groups you'll read about in Blomberg, but just to say a few things about them. The Essenes, for example, were a group of Jews, some of them who were located at Qumran, where the Dead Sea Scrolls were gathered. Some others who, it seems, were located in Jerusalem and in other sects. They viewed themselves as the true Jews and as the true priesthood, who were carrying on the true religion. They did not go to the temple. They did not observe temple observance because it was so corrupt by the Sadducees and the high priests and so on. And they were generally an apocalyptic group. They looked to themselves as being eventually, when Messiah returned, they would set up Jerusalem's new temple, the temple of Ezekiel, and they would be the true Jews who God would bless at that time. The Essenes were wiped out in AD 70. Then you have the Sicarii, S-I-C-A-R-I-I, or Zealots. And the Zealots were kind of a loose band of people, usually of the lower classes, bandits and so on, but were nationalists, and they seem to have had a large involvement in the revolt against Rome in AD 66 through 70. We're not really sure too much about them. Josephus speaks of a fourth philosophy in Antiquities 18:9, and some people regard them as the Zealots, who some of them were followers of Judas the Galilean, who died in AD 6, and some of them were just people who saw themselves as Jewish nationalists, following the great hero Phinehas of the Old Testament, and of course the Maccabees as well. They took the term zealot, particularly during the Jewish revolts, but often they would not or should not be seen as composing all of the people who were called zealots. And so Simon Zelotes, Simon the Zealot, who's spoken of in Luke 6, 15, for example, you have to understand these were not necessarily freedom fighters. These were just people who were noted as zealots for the Jewish way of life. And so when we're talking about zealots, we need to make that clear. We're not talking here about people who necessarily were the same as the Sicarii, who Josephus names as being assassins, wearing a short dagger, the sicca, concealed in their robes to stab enemies in the crowd. Simon Zelotes was probably not one of those. There were other groups, but those were the main factors, the main ones that made up the Jewish groups of the time.